You're listening to Strange by Nature, your guide to the strange, weird, unbelievable, and improbable wonders of the natural world.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for being here today. I am Kirk Mona, and I am joined today by Rachel Ginza and Victoria Thompson. We are all professional naturalists who together have scoured the world for weird and wonderful wonders just to please your mammalian brain's desire for novelty. Isn't that nice? Let's do this.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the show. I am starting us off this week.
Yay!
A few weeks ago, I visited coastal North Carolina. Actually, it was for a friend's mother's memorial service, sadly. And I was there with
ask
several.
If you found any horseshoe crabs, but never mind.
Well, no, but I did go to the beach, as I'm going to discuss. I was there with several close friends from college, and it was pretty chilly and breezy, in fact, while we were there, and not really beach weather. But on our final morning before we left for the airport, we did stop at a beach and get out for a short walk, basically just to be able to say we'd done it, since all of us live in inland areas. And, you know, I saw some cool stuff. I did not see any horseshoe crabs, but I saw a flock of cedar waxwings in the dune shrubs there.
Cool.
Picked up a few shells for my kids. And as we walked along, we saw a few brown pelicans skimming along over the water.
Nice.
And my friend Amy, who is also a friend of the show and member of the Society of Strange, said, "You should do an episode on pelicans."
Oh, nice.
Yes.
And I said, "Yeah, that's a great idea.
I love
it." And really,
they are certainly weird.
They're such funny looking birds.
We've
and I don't think
pelican
we've talked
adjacent.
About them before. We had the pelican, what was it?
We've had pelican
what was that?
Fish, pelican eel. We've had the pelican
fish,
spider.
Pelican spider.
Yeah.
About.
God, yeah. That thing was the goofiest looking spider on earth.
Yeah.
Not an actual pelican, though.
No.
No, no.
Of which there are only 8 species worldwide.
Really?
They are quite widespread, though, and can be found in most temperate and tropical areas wherever water is available. Some even breed in central Australia in the ephemeral salt lakes that are created there after rainstorms. So like the lake only is there for a few months and the pelicans just very quickly get it on and raise some chicks.
Whoa. Okay, cool.
I guess so.
Life finds a way.
Life finds a way. Here in North America, we have the American white pelican, which is found in really most areas west of the Mississippi, including here in Minnesota.
I had a flock of 50 of them fly over my head while I was teaching about birds today. So that was a
nice
choice moment. Thank
convenient.
You. Thank you, Mother Nature. Right on cue.
Oh, love it when that
and
happens.
The brown pelican, which is what I saw in North Carolina, is found along both the Atlantic and Pacific coasts, all the way from New Jersey to the mouth of the Amazon and Washington State, all the way down to Peru.
They're
and
really
also throughout
cool.
the Caribbean and the Galapagos. They are really cool. And pelicans in general, they're very large-bodied birds with kind of medium-length, slender necks and huge heads with these enormous beaks. They have short, stocky legs with webbed feet. They're kind of awkward if they're walking around on land, but they're quite well adapted to the water and the air. They're up there with swans for being some of the longest and heaviest freshwater birds.
Yeah, they're huge.
They're really big. And actually, the wingspans of some of the larger species of pelican can be almost as big as that of albatrosses, which is a very big wingspan. And so,
gigantic.
Yeah. As you would expect with wings like that, they are excellent at soaring. They can do it for long periods of time, either up high or down low over the water, which has some aerodynamic advantages. And they are good swimmers, and they actually float with most of their body out of the water. And this is due to air sacs under the skin, which fact led me on the deep dive into the avian respiratory system that I talked about last week.
There we go. All right.
I had to find that connection somewhere.
All makes sense now.
Yep. So if you haven't heard that episode yet and you want to know more about the wild world of avian breathing, which is really wild, go and take a listen to last week's episode.
Oh.
But yes, obviously the most distinctive feature of pelicans are those gigantic pouches underneath their bills.
Mm-hmm.
They have these very long, narrow, straight bills, and they have a hook just at the tip. And the pouch is just stretchy skin that's suspended from the bottom of their lower beak, the mandible. And it can hold, I read, about 20 liters or up to 5 gallons of water, which would makes it hard to lift their head if they actually have that.
Think about the size of a 5 gallon bucket.
That is.
And imagine just pouring that down your gullet, you know, and
I can barely lift that with my arms.
Right?
Right.
I'm not sure if they actually ever put that much water. I mean, they can't really. I think if they have that much, they can't really lift their head, so they kind of have to press their beak against their chest to squeeze the water.
Well, they'd be straining that out very quickly, probably. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. They, of course, are generally fish eaters. They can catch larger fish with the hook at the tip of the beak, toss it up, swallow it head first, which is fun to see. And, of course, they can hunt by scooping up a whole mouthful of water and fish. And then they slowly raise the beak and the water spills out over the sides, leaving just the fish. But pelicans do not only eat fish. They eat pretty much whatever animal they can fit in their mouth.
I've seen some very, very funny like GIFs of like pelicans trying to eat like a, like fitting their beak around like a cat.
Yep. You can entertain yourself on the internet for quite a while looking at videos of pelicans swallowing ducklings and pigeons, which is a very awkward process, let me tell you, because, of course, the pigeon doesn't die right away. So mm-hmm. you can see it like fluttering around in the pelican's gullet.
Oh,
just
my
sounds extremely uncomfortable for both of them, really.
Yeah.
And
choices were made.
Yeah. pelicans also sometimes attempt to eat ludicrously larger animals than themselves, including capybaras.
That's
cormorants.
What I was thinking of. Not a cat, a capybara.
What?
Terriers and human toddlers.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, they're not good. No.
Not successfully. Not successfully. But
that's good. That's
the attempt
good.
Was made.
Wow.
So pelican reproduction is kind of interesting. Usually mother pelicans lay 1 to 3 eggs, but typically only one survives. There's siblicide. So yeah, the stronger chick will kill or outcompete the others, which is sadly common in the bird world. And this is pretty usual way of parents feeding their chicks for the first week or so. The parents regurgitate food for the chicks. And then afterwards, the chicks are able to retrieve food for themselves from the parents' pouch.
Gross.
But there is some really weird behavior that starts to happen.
Oh, no.
So with older chicks, before they let them have food, the parents will sometimes grab the chick and drag it around by the head very roughly.
What?
Okay.
Which the hypothesis is that this may be a method of discouraging chicks that are not their own from trying to get food from them. Like, no other chicks that are not their own will not tolerate it, but only their own chicks will stand up for the abuse.
Okay.
And
we need to work on their self-worth.
Yes.
Yes.
For our listeners who are familiar with the behavior of young human children, you may be interested to know that pelican chicks also can be huge tantrum-throwing drama queens.
Beautiful.
Gotcha.
When a chick is feeding by reaching its beacon, sometimes before, but usually after they're fed, the chick will then start making noise, flapping around, dragging one wing along the ground, moving its head up and down, finally falling on the ground, screeching and writhing as if it were having a seizure.
Wow.
Sounds familiar.
It's all a
sham. I think I've seen this once or twice.
Yeah. It's a little unclear why they do this, but it may be trying to keep their parents' attention on them instead of letting the parents go on and feed their siblings.
Sounds about right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And for ground nesting pelicans, once chicks are about 25 days old, they actually gather together in big groups, which are called creches, which
That's
is like
so
the French
funny.
Word for nursery.
Okay.
And these groups can be as big as 100 chicks, but the parents are able to pick out their own chicks among all the others and feed only their own kids.
Okay.
So no communal feeding in the pelican breeding world.
It's kind of interesting, especially since they're all grouped together like that. You'd think there would be.
Yeah.
Hmm.
I mean, that may be where the head dragging comes in. I don't know.
Fair enough.
Yeah. That's really all I have in pelicans this week. They're strange looking birds and they have some pretty odd behaviors and adaptations. And that's what I'm sharing. Yeah. My sources this week were the Firefly Encyclopedia of Birds Wikipedia and a January 1939 article in The Condor, which is called Functional Aspects of the Pneumatic System in the California Brown Pelican by Frank Richardson. He basically got a couple of pelican carcasses and blew air in them to see how the air sacs worked. So that's fun.
Okay.
That's a choice.
Someone's got to do it.
Yep.
Okay.
Science.
Science. I feel like they did more things like that back in 1939.
Yeah, I think so.
We just talk about it more eloquently now.
Yes. Or at least more more confusingly for the layperson.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, Kirk will have something else for us.
Yeah. All right, everybody, welcome back. One of the really amazing things, I think I've mentioned this on the show before, but something I had the honor of doing as a naturalist is going on a dinosaur dig in the Hell Creek Formation in North Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
It was honestly one of the coolest things I've ever done in my life. Another naturalist, Becca, and I took a bunch of middle school students in a 15-passenger van out basically into the very northern part of the Badlands and worked with an organization out there to spend a week digging up dinosaurs. We found parts of Triceratops, Dromaeosaurs, fish, turtles, basically a big, nice cross-section of Cretaceous life.
Wow, cool.
And once That's you've been so cool. out in the field working on a dig, you realize why our knowledge of the past is so incomplete. The work is hard, slow, and hot. Conditions have to be exactly right for fossils to form. And you may find a rich fossil bed in one spot, and a few feet over, there's nothing. And if you think about it like today, if an animal dies in my backyard, it's not going to become a fossil because the conditions are not correct.
Yes.
And then, you know, some fossils can get weathered away and not be there anymore. And back basically 65 million years ago, there were some spots that just happened to be right to produce fossils. But like if it was a few feet over, just like today, it may not be the right spot. So even if you happen to find an amazing site where a large dinosaur was found, you then have a problem of figuring out how to get it out. They can weigh thousands of pounds.
Right, 'cause it's
and rock. You may be many, many, many miles from the nearest road. But once you somehow finally figure out how to get it out, there could be years and years and years of cleaning and prep work and removing the surrounding matrix of rocks, just little tiny layer by tiny layer at a time to reveal the fossil before you can learn every secret it holds. So when you think about all the work that's involved, it's kind of a wonder that we know anything at all, let alone that we've already figured out as much as we have about the past.
Yeah, your so explanation made me exhausted just even thinking about that.
Yes.
Yeah, it was so much fun, but like we carried like a thigh bone of a single dinosaur out, and it took like a whole team of people carrying this one bone encased in plaster, and it was super heavy. So, you know, it's a ton of work. And it shouldn't be a surprise then that we're still learning things and making new discoveries, even in places that have already been explored, because they're just huge, huge areas, right? Mm-hmm. There's just so much ground to cover and so few people who are actually dedicated to being out there every single day. Most paleontologists are not doing field work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're studying stuff that's already been collected in museums. There's very few people out there who are working every day doing the field work to collect those specimens that get studied later on.
Well, I know part of that too is like funding wise. That could be really hard to get funding.
Absolutely.
And stuff too. So.
Absolutely. So I was delighted by a story that came out of the Hell Creek Formation back in 2019, and I'm finally getting around to share it here on the podcast. This is from a research paper published in one of our favorite journals with a terrible acronym for the name. This is from the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, or as it's known, PNAS. The paper has a pretty dry title. It was called A Seismically Induced Onshore Surge Deposit at the KPG Boundary, North Dakota. It sounds kind of boring, but oh man, is this paper anything but dry. So the first clue that something special is going on here is the mention of the KPG boundary.
Yeah.
For those old school among us, these used to be called the KT boundary, meaning the Cretaceous Tertiary boundary.
Right.
But they changed the name of the tertiary period to the Paleogene. So now we get the KPG boundary.
Oh my gosh.
And this is...
when did they do that?
This is a layer of rock.
I missed that memo.
A while back. Yeah. This is, you learn things at a certain time, and if you don't use them every day, you assume nothing has changed. But
yeah.
This is a layer of rock that marks the boundary between two time periods in Earth's history. And the cool thing is that this is not a gradual thing. This is a very sharp line between these two periods. And this boundary has long fascinated paleontologists because below this line, you have the Cretaceous period and there's abundant plant and animal life. And above this line, there isn't much of anything. This line represents a massive, absolutely massive extinction event here on Earth. And some really interesting things have been found in this thin, dark boundary line, including the charred remains of plants and trace amounts of the very rare mineral iridium, which is usually mostly only found in objects from space, like asteroids. So, putting the evidence together, scientists were able to surmise that a large meteor struck the Earth, scattering debris, fire, and death around the world. And it wasn't until geologists were working in the petroleum industry who were searching for oil down in Mexico in the late 1970s. And they started to get readings that indicated there was a crater. And it's now known as the, there's different pronunciations out there, but I believe Chicxulub crater.
Mm-hmm.
And we now think this is where this this body impacted the Earth. The crater is 110 miles in diameter. You won't be able to see it on a map because it's underground today. But the crater is basically centered near the Yucatan Peninsula in southern Mexico.
Isn't it underwater? And
yeah.
It is underwater, yeah. Partially under land, partially underwater. To give you an idea of the size of the impact and the effects, we're going to go to the paper from 2019 and what they discovered in North Dakota, 1,900 miles away from the impact. What they're able to find at this site was an estimate of an earthquake. They basically showed that there had been an earthquake. Now, this is a little confusing because the scale that many listeners are familiar with is like the Richter scale, and they use the what's called the moment magnitude scale, which is a completely different scale. But luckily, the numbers line up and are calibrated to each other. So
thanks, guys.
You don't need
Yay.
To. Yeah. Woo, thank you so much. They estimated that in North Dakota, minutes to hours after the impact in Mexico, a seismic wave reached North Dakota, or what's now North Dakota, that was a magnitude 10 or 11 earthquake.
What? Oh. Oh.
Yeah. Now, we've talked about earthquakes on the show before. I talked about how we can never have a magnitude 10 earthquake on Earth because there is not a fault line on Earth long enough to move to create a quake of that scale. The largest ever recorded, which is ridiculous, was in the 1960s in Chile.
Yes.
And we believe that was a 9.5. Now, this scale is logarithmic. That means that this earthquake was 10 to 100 times larger than any natural earthquake ever on Earth. So imagine
the mind boggles.
The largest earthquake on Earth, multiply it by 100 times.
I just have a bunch of swears like. Going through my head right now.
Keep in mind, not at the impact site, but 3,000 kilometers or 1,900 miles away.
Yep.
So the shaking
Christ.
Must have been unfathomably violent. Impact was nothing short of cataclysmic. And in 2008, researchers discovered a special site in the Hell Creek Formation, and they named it the Tanis Site. And I'm assuming it was named after the highly important archaeological site of the same name in Egypt. I couldn't find anything to verify that, but I'm also sort of assuming that the person who named it was also a big Indiana Jones fan, as a story of Raiders of the Lost Ark is all about the Tanis site. And I think there's a big overlap between people who are field techs looking for fossils and also fans of Indiana Jones. So I'm assuming that's where this name came from. So the asteroid striking the Earth had lots of impacts, no pun intended. And when they were looking around, they found the evidence of a river. And rivers are often a good spot to have fossil formation. And so they named this the Tanis River. And then they named this whole area the Tanis Site after what they found there. And so there, you might think there'd be a tsunami created by the asteroid impacting, and there very likely was, but they found the evidence of waves that were caused by the earthquake that were not a tsunami. And it's confusing because earthquakes cause tsunamis, but this was not like a tsunami would be waves created at the impact site that then travel to another place. Whereas if the earthquake arrives somewhere and creates waves that are at the same time as the earthquake, that's a different phenomenon than a tsunami.
Okay.
So they found evidence of this enormous, you know, wave that was created perhaps as little as just 10 minutes after the impact they estimated it could take. And these waves, they think, were anywhere between 10 and 100 meters high. For those of you using, American units, that's 33 to 328 foot high waves. And these waves were in the Western Interior Seaway. So if you picture North America and picture like a big giant shallow ocean or sea kind of splitting North America in half, that's what it was like 65 million years ago. And a giant wave came like flooding through there. This flood washed animals from the sea, animals from the land, together. Freshwater animals were mixed with ocean plants, other debris, and all kinds of stuff just washed up this river. They could actually see, because of the way that the bedding works in the river from all the sands, that the river changed direction. Okay, so the water came up, and they show evidence of multiple waves that came very far inland from this event. And I'm just going to read now some of the things that they have learned from this site, because it's such an incredible, incredible site, and you'll start to understand why. So the deposits they found, like I said, indicate that the river changed direction, which is pretty wild. Animals and plant material were preserved in three-dimensional detail. And often fossils are squished flat, right? But this event happened so fast, and all the deposits covered everything up so fast, things are preserved in three-dimensional detail, which is fairly rare around the world. So that's really exciting, because you get a lot more information. They found articulated and cartilaginous salt and freshwater fish and marine reptiles that were all found together miles inland. And then what's just crazy is when you have an asteroid impact the Earth, it basically melts the land and ejects it up into the sky in fiery debris that basically forms glass.
Tektites.
And when that glass falls down, exactly, it's called a tektite. They found microtektites in North Dakota from the impact down in Mexico, almost 2,000 miles away.
Whoa.
So imagine this giant, and those seem to have arrived about the same time as the earthquake. So about 10 minutes or so after impact, this earthquake comes, water starts, you know, rushing in from the sea, and then just this unholy rain of melted glass starts pelting down out of the sky. And they found these fish that have been washed up, basically their gills were embedded with microtectites. They were trying to breathe in the water, and there was so many microtectites in the water, they were breathing them in and getting them stuck in their lungs, where they then fossilized. So like, that's this fossil wild. Site captured the moment of like the end, right? It's not just like, oh yeah, everything above this site is you know, no longer the Cretaceous time period. This was the end that they captured, which is just fascinating. They found two new species of paddlefish they'd never been seen before. They found millions of these microtectites. And when they did chemical like analysis of them, they found that they were chemically identical to the ones that were from down in Mexico. They found them, you know, buried in the fossils. They found little impact craters in the riverbed that had tectites inside them. They even found tree trunks that had amber oozing out of it, and microtectites got stuck in the amber and preserved in the amber.
Whoa. Wow.
So the sky must have been just filled with debris, just violently raining down everywhere at the time this happened. It just paints such an amazing picture.
Terrifying.
They found a turtle that had been killed by being impaled on a tree branch from the violent wave.
Oh my goodness.
They did find also broken remains of, you know, pretty much every dinosaur that's known from the Hell Creek Formation. They found fossils of intact eggs with embryos in them. They found fossils of hatchlings. They found fossil pterosaurs.
Whoa.
And there's no other fossils of those from that time. They found large primitive feathers that were 30 to 40 centimeters long that probably came from dinosaurs. They even found drowned ant nests that had like these tektites and asteroid debris packed into the top of the ant nest. And they could see all the burrows. There were still ants inside these anthills.
That's so cool.
Wow.
Dang.
They found burrows from some of the first mammals on Earth.
Cool.
And some of those first mammals were still inside the burrows when they got killed.
What?
Wow.
So
they
found so much amazing stuff at this site that some people are calling it like one of the richest and most amazing fossil finds ever. This was found, like I said, back in 2008. It was kept a very big secret, kept very quiet because they didn't want anyone to know about it. I'm sure it must have been excruciating not to tell people about it, but they really needed to preserve this site and didn't really start releasing papers on it until just recently.
Wow.
And they are still studying it. This is still an active site. One of my favorite little things to leave you with this, which I think is so cool, is by analyzing the fish skeletons, and looking at modern fish and knowing how fish's bodies change throughout the year, we now know that the asteroid that impacted Earth and brought the end of the dinosaurs impacted in the springtime.
That's so cool. And,
it doesn't matter, but I love knowing that. It's like the fact that we can know what time of year basically the dinosaurs ended. It's like, it was not a winter day, it was not a summer day, not a fall day, it was a spring day when the asteroid impacted. And this particular site, this Tanis site in North Dakota, is giving us incredible insight into the last minutes of the Cretaceous time period and how the dinosaurs were wiped out. So and this is an area that we've studied for a very, very, very long time, and just no one had found this site. Right? Because other areas that maybe you have lots of good fossils from, maybe that riverbed had dried up a million years later, right? Or thousands of years later. So this just happens to be, we finally found a site that had the conditions that were right to actually create fossils right in that last moment after the asteroid hit. Super
amazing.
Cool.
That's so cool.
So this article that I was reading was called A Seismically Induced Onshore Surge Deposit at the KPG Boundary in North Dakota. That's in PNAS. If you want to read the whole thing, super cool, super cool. I just had to share it because it's like, it's so strange. And the fact that scientists can learn these things about the past by studying it so closely and be lucky enough to find this site after all these years just sort of blows my mind. It makes me want to get back out there and go digging. So,
you know, Kirk, I just pulled up this paper as you were mentioning the title, and I see that one of the authors is Walter Alvarez, who he was with his father, Luis. Alvarez was one of the originators of the hypothesis that a meteorite impact was what killed the dinosaurs. So he's like big granddaddy of that whole thing.
Yeah, so he was like, I got a little something to add to the story.
Yeah.
Very cool.
And I don't know if I've told you guys this before, but my grandfather was a geologist and he was a specialist in tektites. So.
Yeah, I remember you mentioned you have some.
Yeah.
Very cool. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, it'll be Rachel.
I don't think I can follow that up, Kirk.
You're going to have to try.
All right, welcome back, everyone. I'm going to flat out say I'm still reeling a bit from all the dinosaur fossilization knowledge that has been like given to me. So
heaved upon
so cool. But I do have something that I find really fascinating. Maybe not the most strange, but is still a pretty cool thing. So this is one of the first plants I distinctly remember. So we're going to go way, way back to baby naturalist Rachel. I'm an intern. Kirk, you remember seeing intern Rachel. Victoria.
Yeah.
I think this is before we met Victoria.
I have a photo I just saw the other day of intern Rachel with a red-tailed hawk sitting on her hand.
Oh, that wasn't intern Rachel, though, I don't think.
Oh, maybe it went to me. We don't let interns do that. So this was
even before
you were even younger, I guess.
Anyway.
Oh my gosh.
So picture me, little intern Rachel, going about and exploring. And I learn on a hike. I can't remember exactly why we were doing this hike. I think we were starting to learn. I was getting the overview of pond study, or maybe we had gone out with one of the other naturalists who is at a different site now. And she went over and she was like, "Hey, have you heard about this plant?" And I, of course, had not, because I was still learning. And she came over and she showed me this plant and showed me all these different adaptations. This is what I'm going to talk about today. I'm going to talk about this plant because it's actually even cooler than what she told me in that time period.
Oh, great.
But it was like one of the first like moments of naturalist natural history that I got, to the point where I took that knowledge, and I think like a week or so later I went and got ice cream with a friend of mine, saw some, recognized it, picked some, so that way I could show her, because we weren't near any water, I held it until we got to the ice cream place where there was a cup of water. And then I put the plant in the water to show her this really cool property. So this particular plant, the leaves, especially on the underside, are hydrophobic, which means that they don't attract water. They actually repel water molecules. It's like a little layer. It doesn't allow them to do anything. It kind of bead on the bottom. And I'm showing a friend of mine at this Ben and Jerry's, and she's like, cool. And then I see, like,
you're a giant nerd.
I'm a giant nerd. It gets worse because there was like a kid or two behind me in line for ice cream, because of course there was. And I like bend down and I'm like, "You want to see something cool?" And I like show them my little leaf of plant in the cup. I will state there was a dad who was right there watching this happen, and he called over. He had like 3 or 4 kids with him. He's like, "Hey, come here. You got to see this." Wow. So I felt proud. And that was like the moment where I'm like, I'm in the right field. The particular plant right. that I picked and showed off in a Ben and Jerry's ice cream shop is one that we often see in very marshy spaces. It's jewelweed, also known touch me not. It's known as jewelweed because when it is upside down, especially, the leaves look very silvery. That's due to the hydrophobic qualities on the leaf. And that's probably where the name comes from. So jewelweed, also known as touch me not, is an annual plant. It only grows 3 to 5 feet, so less than one Rachel tall. And generally, which, great, but it's a really like big bushy space. The leaves are like a three-lobed leaf that is like a pretty like solid green, has some like edging to it and everything. What really defines jewelweed and how you can really identify it is the bright orange flowers. They look kind of like cones that go out, and then they have like an opening at, I don't know, they kind of remind me of traffic cones almost, attached to a plant, but very small and just orange. Kind of like a, almost like a trumpet, or maybe even like a, if you look at them from the side, like a praying mantis.
I think of them as like a little cornucopia. Like a little horn of plenty kind of thing.
Yeah, that
they look
also
a little
works.
Similar to a snapdragon flower, I feel like.
Yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely. And they're like orange or yellow, depending on where which species you're looking at. They also grow these big bulbs on them, on their stems, which are full of this sap, which I think also is a great way to be able to identify jewelweed. One of the ways that they do get their name is that touch me not, the seed, when the flowers go and they start having their seeds, they get these little bean pods. They remind me of string beans, and they are this bright, bright green. And when they're ready to go, we've talked about this type of seed dispersal before on the show, but if they even get brushed by anything, a feather, another seed, they will burst open and just explode as far away as they possibly can, which is a really cool way to, it's called a explosive dehiscence, which we've talked about before. And it's a really cool way to be able to disperse your seeds.
In surgery, that's dehiscence is what happens if you have surgery and then you're wound reopens.
Awful.
Difficult image for me, but good to know that.
Good vocab
that's,
word.
That's fair. Gross. Awful. Hate that. Yeah, so it's a really cool little plant, but what I wanted to talk a little bit about is just like, it doesn't seem like overly strange, but what is really cool about this particular plant, about this plant, is one, you are able to eat the seeds. Those are edible, which is pretty cool.
Did not know that.
The young shoots can be boiled as a type of herb, but you can't eat too much because there's like calcium oxalate crystals in them, so you don't want to eat too much of that. But what I really wanted to talk about is, besides the fact that it can blow up and it looks kind of silvery and is hydrophobic, which truly for a plant feels weird to me, like having a plant be hydrophobic, especially since it grows in the wetland. There's a lot of knowledge that gets passed on along verbally between naturalists and between people in communities. And one that I've heard, and I can actually confirm because it has been studied scientifically, is that it was a traditional method to relieve poison ivy. Now, this is only for like short term, but it has been proven through Western science to be able to do that. Through a couple different methods, actually. There was this study that was going through and testing the efficacy of jewelweed as a poison ivy rash, which, by the way, was done two people's arms. Like they had somebody, they had multiple individuals poison ivy on their arm and then do this, like try the different methods, which, okay, I guess. But
don't like that.
They were able to, I don't love that either. They were able to, one, mash up the plant itself, like the stem itself. They want the sap and the juices in the plant. That is truly what is giving the cure, I suppose.
The relief
for poison ivy, the remedy. They also made it into soap, and made it like a extract soap, which worked okay. Between the extract soap and the plant mash actually worked better, but it only worked for short-term relief and short-term like exposure. Like if you like laid down overnight in a patch of poison ivy, which don't do that.
Don't like that.
This isn't going to help you. But if you just barely brushed a bit of poison ivy and you happen to see jewelweed right there and can mash it up, that can actually relieve some of your systems. And part of that is because it contains saponins, which is, it's usually a toxic organic form or whatever, but it is able to like take out some of the active ingredients in poison ivy, make it the rash less itchy and less widespread, which is really great. The stem juice which is able to treat athlete's foot because of similar
really?
Right? Which because of similar properties that it does with the poison ivy. It has a fungicidal quality for it that allows it to actually like treat athlete's foot, I guess, which is pretty cool.
Doesn't it also work for mosquito bites?
Yes. Same kind of idea when it comes to the poison ivy. If you use it for mosquito bites, it helps it not itch as much. So it's pretty cool. It's found all over the United States and is a really, really good pollinator plant for many different types of pollinators, including hummingbirds and bees. So
in my ecology class in college, we actually did a field study on jewelweed pollination by hummingbirds. Got to sit and watch a patch of jewelweed.
That's so
and did
cool.
you see any hummingbirds?
Yeah, did.
Nice. Oh, be really boring if you
so
hadn't.
Cool.
I mean, there were other pollinators too.
Sure.
So that's all I have for you all this week. My sources were the USDA. They had a whole article on jewelweed or touch me not. The USDA, which what I just said. There we go. The Forest Service in particular had one. As well as Wikipedia and the Washington State Control Board had one. Thanks everyone for listening. We'll see you next week. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks everyone for listening to today's show. Be sure to subscribe. New episodes drop every Wednesday, and we love sharing this strange world with all of our listeners. If you would be so kind as to leave us a 5-star review, that would be great. It lets other lovers of the strange discover the show. You can reach out to us on social media by searching for Strange by Nature Podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. You can send us an email as well. Our address is contact@strangebynaturepodcast.com. If you want more information about the show, you can also check out our website, which is strangebynaturepodcast.com. Until next week, get outside, stay curious, and embrace the strange.